From Minnesota to Virginia, Iowa to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, October's jobs numbers are out. Michael Farron from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University says there is good news, but some storm clouds are on the horizon. That massive $1.5 trillion infrastructure bill has passed Congress, but is it really about infrastructure? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Once again, we've turned our clocks back, but is the semi-annual ritual of time change now causing more harm than good? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jeffrey Singer from the Cato Institute. And could the decline in the number of veterans serving in Congress be one cause of the inability of lawmakers to work together as a cohesive unit? Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA says it is on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. After a couple of disappointing months, October's jobs number showed a healthy rebound, but the data indicates problems lie ahead. Michael Farron is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He is here to sort through the numbers. Michael, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Michael, October jobs numbers are out. The report actually pretty good. Want to tell us what the numbers showed?
Yeah, the numbers showed 531,000 jobs added to payrolls across the country and a drop of 0.2 percentage points in the unemployment rate. So it's now down to 4.6%. That means that this kind of drop in the unemployment rate continues, we're going to be back to a pre-pandemic unemployment rate by about midwinter.
Taking a look at those numbers, we did have sort of disappointing numbers in August and September, or at least in September. So is this a correction to those numbers, or does it represent an improvement in the economy?
I would say that it's probably both. We saw diminished employment gains in August and September, substantially diminished. We expected about 750,000 new jobs in August. The number originally put out was about 235,000, so a huge miss. Similar, around 500,000 jobs expected in September was less than 200,000. Those numbers have now been revised, given that additional information has come in. And this is actually a very standard revision. The numbers get updated for the first 2 months after they have initially been published, as the surveys that have been sent out gradually trickle in. But these adjustments are much larger than we would typically see. For the October jobs reports, the adjustments to October and August and September were over 100,000 additional jobs. So August, now the final number is 483,000 jobs added in August, and September, we'll get one more correction to that, but it's 312,000 jobs for September. So things were a bit better than we anticipated, but we definitely saw a fall off because in July, over 1 million new jobs were created. And so we're seeming to go through surges and ebbs so far this year as we're trying to recover from the pandemic. The beginning of 2021 was very slow. It surged a little bit more early spring. It fell off late spring. It surged again early summer. It's fallen off again. The good news is that we continue to add new jobs, that we haven't got stuck in a plateau so far.
We continue to add new jobs. However, we're seeing a lot of businesses reporting that they simply cannot find workers to fill those jobs. So is there a ready and willing labor pool out there to keep this momentum going forward?
That is probably the underlying bad news in this, what would otherwise be fairly optimistic jobs report. And that would be that the labor force participation rate is still substantially lower than it had been previously, about a 1.3 percentage points lower, which is several million workers lower than what we would otherwise expect. And once you accommodate the anticipated employment gains and younger workers coming into the labor force that would have occurred over this past year and a half during the pandemic, what you would expect to see is a labor force that's about 6 million workers larger than we currently have. So a big question is, where are all of these additional workers? We should actually be seeing the unemployment rate go up as these workers come back into the labor force rather than go down. About 1.5 to 2 million of those workers can be attributed to early retirements. And given that the pandemic predominantly and more severely affected older individuals, and the stock market after initial speed bump, substantial speed bump, recovered very quickly, you couldn't fault people who retired early or retired before they would have otherwise intended to retire. But we're still left with about 4 million workers who, for one reason or another, are not returning to the labor market. And that's got some economists concerned.
We have seen an end to the pandemic unemployment assistance, extra additional money that was given to those who were on unemployment, Michael. There was a lot of thought that once that went away, the worker shortage would resolve itself. From what you're telling me, that is not what's occurring.
That's correct. There continues to be a lot of consternation among the talking heads and economists about this. People saying that, well, you see that people didn't surge back into the labor market after the end of federal expansion to unemployment insurance, and so that must not have been the problem. But at the same time, you didn't see people surge back into the labor market after schools resumed in-session classes across the country. So arguably, that hasn't been as much of a problem. And arguably, the Delta variant probably caused a lot of people to be more concerned about going back to work. But we do have effective vaccines that are widely available for even younger children now. So the question is really up in the air of what is causing this. I think all three answers can still explain some of it. But the financial cushion that a lot of people have access to is probably allowing them to be a little bit more choosy about how they come back to the labor market.
We have been talking with Michael Farron. Michael is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, talking about the October jobs report, what it means, where we may be headed to from here. Michael, tell us a little bit about Mercatus. Also, what's the website where folks can go to read your analysis of this and other reports?
Mercatus is an academic research center that is the bridge between academic research and the public and policymakers who need access to that research. You can find more about the work we do at mercatus.org.
Michael Farron of the Mercatus Center. Michael, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. A lot of action has been taking place on Capitol Hill, which, by the way, is where he is. Scott, we have finally an infrastructure bill, and it looks like some Republicans handed Democrats a big win.
Thanks for having me back, Loman. I think what happened last weekend is sort of an unfortunate exercise of legislating and sort of shooting Republicans in their own foot when we had an opportunity with a bunch of political momentum following Glenn Youngkin's victory in Virginia. And just what I've learned in my 16 years in Washington, D.C., is that we have Republicans, we have Democrats, we have conservatives, we have liberals, and we always have these rhinos, Republicans in name only, that are adamant about giving Democrats big opportunities to advance their own agenda without much input from the Republican Party. And this weekend, we had 13 House Republicans joined forces with most of the Democrats. But the problem here was is that Nancy Pelosi and House Democrats did not have the votes to get to 218, a majority of the House of Representatives, and pass the legislation on their own. They had 6 House Democrats vote no on the bipartisan infrastructure bill that we've talked about for the last several months here. Now, I know your listeners will remember that 19 Republican senators voted to pass that bill with all the Senate Democrats way back in July. But really, this was an opportunity with the Biden agenda, really at a point, a decision point of whether or not they could advance anything President Biden repeatedly was meeting with lawmakers and the Democratic leadership, trying to force them to ultimately take the vote and to have an agreement. And that's what they did. They went ahead and passed this $1.2 trillion infrastructure package.
So the infrastructure package has been passed. There's still that giant so-called Build Back Better bill that's looming out there, Scott. Any chance that that's going to move and be passed also?
Well, you know, they obviously did the first step by adjudicating the bipartisan infrastructure bill, and then the Progressive Caucus, now they get their opportunity to pass the even bigger bill when it comes to size, scope, and cost on the U.S. economy. So the Build Back Better plan, Build Back Worse is kind of what we're calling it. That will continue to be negotiated, but what the House Democrats did right after they passed the bipartisan infrastructure bill was they passed the rule allowing for debate and consideration of the reconciliation bill. And so we'll be seeing that in the coming weeks here in November, and we'll see how the negotiations shake out and what kind of a bill can make it through the House and consideration over in the United States Senate.
A lot of action still remaining here this year, that and also the budget and the national debt limitation, all that coming up yet in December. But let's shift gears, because there's been some interesting developments in U.S. Senate races that will be taking place in 2022. And Scott, let's start in the state of New Hampshire, which is one of the states Republicans have high hopes of picking up a seat. What occurred there these last few days?
Well, New Hampshire's Governor Sununu decided that he is not going to run for the United States Senate. And that's a little bit of a setback in terms of candidate recruitment from the National Republican Senatorial Committee and Mitch McConnell and Rick Scott. Sununu is seen really as the best candidate that could help pick up that seat against Senator Hassan. But instead, we're hearing that a former United States Senator, Kelly Ayotte, is taking another look at whether or not she wants to get in that race.
Moving past New Hampshire, as we look at the battlegrounds for next year, Scott, what other states are shaping up as, first of all, pickup opportunities for Republicans, but also Democrats have a few opportunities?
Yeah, I think the pickup opportunities for Republicans are in Arizona, Georgia, and Nevada. And in Arizona, you've got several candidates that are running. Jim Lehman, Blake Masters are two of the front runners, and then you've also got the Attorney General Brunovich. And then in Georgia, it looks like Herschel Walker is going to be the Republican nominee there. President Trump has already made an endorsement in that race. And then in Nevada, President Trump and also the Club for Growth PAC have endorsed Adam Laxalt, Nevada's former Attorney General and the grandson of a United States Senator from way back in the day, Paul Laxalt. So those are the pickup opportunities, in my view. Obviously, with the way that the Virginia election looked, maybe there will be other pickup opportunities that emerge in the coming weeks and months. But right now, we think those are the three best opportunities, especially with Governor Sununu taking a pass in New Hampshire. For Democrats, they've got a couple of pickup opportunities in competitive states. I think your home state of Pennsylvania is probably their best opportunity, because Republicans are duking it out with a lot of negative opposition research against Sean Parnell, the Republican front runner, and their candidate, John Fetterman, has raised what I would say is a truckload full of money, and he'll be a very, very competitive candidate in a swing state. Additionally, we're looking at a big open race in North Carolina, which sometimes can be a competitive state. Right now, Club for Growth PAC has endorsed Ted Budd, and he's running against Republican Pat McCrory, their former governor. The Democrats are still sorting out exactly what their side will look like, but we're aggressively supporting the campaign of Ted Budd. And then you have an open race in Alabama with Katie Boyd Britt running against Mo Brooks. This is a open Republican seat. It's not a Democratic pickup opportunity like it was when Doug Jones defeated Roy Moore, but you do have Mo Brooks running against Katie Boyd Britt there. In Missouri, there's another Republican open seat to fill the Senate seat from Roy Blunt, who was a longtime senator and prior to that a member of the House Republican leadership. And their former governor, Eric Greitens, should probably be considered the front runner, just given his previous experience in elected office. But you have other statewide officials like Eric Schmidt, the Attorney General of Missouri, that's running.
We are back into the congressional election cycle now officially, so we will continue to track that. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, typically we hear from you a couple words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. And if you want to learn more, you can check us out at clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually become a member of the club for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, thank you for taking time to be with us.
All right, thank you.
Spring forward, fall back, all of that clock changing once made sense. But has the ritual now become too costly? To find out, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jeffrey Singer from the Cato Institute.
Well, if you're like me, if you live in most of these United States, then you probably spent this week feeling just a little bit tired, a little bit off, because of course, the change in times, daylight savings time coming to an end, back onto standard time. But there are good arguments for why we should just sort of do away with the time change. This is an idea that maybe once made sense that just doesn't anymore. Maybe it never did. And that's what we're going to take a closer look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Singer. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. And he joins us on the phone now from Arizona, from a place in this country that doesn't do the daylight savings time. So he's not been extra tired this week, and that's why he was able to get up early to chat with us today. Dr. Singer, thanks for making some time with us.
Happy to be here.
So the clock change, this the daylight savings time, standard time, all of this, we do this because it once made sense, right? And it's just sort of a vestige of that previous era, or did it never make sense at all, and this is just politics gumming up our clocks?
Well, it was never based on the evidence, but there was a rationale from the beginning. It actually dates back to the 1700s, when Benjamin Franklin was an ambassador to France, and he wrote a letter to the editor of the Journal of Paris suggesting that they go to daylight savings time. So he's sort of the creator of it, because he believed that would decrease the use of candles to keep things light. And so the idea that daylight savings time would reduce energy consumption and conserve electricity, et cetera, that took hold. So for a brief time during World War I and during World War II, for that reason as well, there was daylight savings time. Then in 1966, Congress enacted the Uniform Time Act, which set across the country a daylight savings time begin date and end date, which was revised in 2005. It was extended another 4 months. But basically, with that law, states could opt out, but otherwise this is going to be daylight savings time for the United States of America. And again, the understanding was this was going to save energy. However, a lot of research has been done, and there's really no evidence that it does save energy. For certain industries, it might save energy, but that's offset by other industries where it adds to the energy costs. So all these years later, it's never been shown to really have any benefit in that regard. Same thing with a lot of industries. Some industries like it. For example, the candy industry loves it that it stays light later so kids could get more candy on Halloween evening. On the other hand, dairy farmers hate it because it's dark longer in the mornings and they milk their cows real early in the morning.
So there are both winners and losers economically, I guess, from the clock change, but all that comes out in the wash. Probably the more important point here, and it's a point that you make in your piece that folks can find this week at The Hill, pick a time and stick with it. That's the headline on the piece at thehill.com by Dr. Jeffrey Singer. The point you make here is that there are some real health consequences from the clock change, not necessarily the result of daylight savings time or standard time, really, but the result of this going back and forth twice a year.
A lot of research has shown that associated with the switches, you know, the springing ahead or falling back, there's an increased rate of stroke and heart attack, increased automobile accidents, mood swings, increase incidences of depression, and also increase automobile accidents. There's even some reason to believe that it may affect your immune system and liver function. So you have all of these harmful health effects, both physical and mental, that are trade-offs of what's supposed to be something that saves energy, but really never has been shown to do so.
We are talking with Dr. Jeffrey Singer. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and the author of a piece you can find at The Hill this week about the negative consequences of the back and forth clock change that we go through, that we just went through last weekend as we go back into standard time now for the next 4 months. Dr. Singer, not a whole lot of time left here, but I do want to get to sort of the thrust of your piece, which is it's not necessarily about picking between daylight savings time or standard time, but more like just the necessity of choosing one or the other. Am I right?
Well, most of the research suggests it's a change. Now, there are arguments that are they're good arguments made on this, either side of should we just abandon daylight savings time and return to standard time, or should we just add another 4 months to the already 8 months of the year that are daylight savings time and make daylight savings time the time year-round, make it the standard time. And there are good arguments on both sides, but from a medical science point perspective, the key is the switch in time that hits the body, and it affects people for at least a week. And so my position on it is just pick one and whatever the majority of people want and go with that one and stop making the changes all the time. There was a survey done recently by the Farmers Almanac, and they found that when they asked the public, would you rather go to daylight savings time or standard time, they were pretty evenly split on that. And so I would go with whichever the majority picks as the one. There is a bill that was introduced by Senator Marco Rubio back in March called the Sunshine Protection Act of 2021 that would just basically extend 4 months onto daylight savings time and make daylight savings time the standard time permanently year-round. And that already has 14 sponsors, 8 Republicans and 6 Democrats. And then there's a similar bill that was introduced in the House of Representatives by Vern Buchanan. So this seems to be one of those rare issues that you can get people, regardless of political party or ideology, it's time to do something about it.
Well, that is unfortunately all the time that we have to talk about time today. Big thanks to Dr. Jeffrey Singer from the Cato Institute for joining us. Check out his regular work online at cato.org, and also click on over to thehill.com to find his piece this week. Pick a time and stick with it. You know, maybe we can get some bipartisan agreement on doing away with standard time or daylight savings time, one or the other. I'm not holding my breath, but, you know, maybe someday. Again, thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Singer.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out my work online at reason.com and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
We recently celebrated Veterans Day. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says, it is important that we continue to honor those who have kept our nation safe.
Veterans Day was just a few days ago, so I thought it might be a good time to think about the role of the military in American society today. There are about 18 million veterans in the U.S., and the percentage of the U.S. population with military experience has been continually shrinking since the end of the draft in 1973. In 1980, about 18% of all U.S. adults were veterans, so that means that well over a third of all men were veterans. Today, it's only 7% overall. As a nation, we are justly proud that our military is 100% volunteers. But as a veteran myself during the Vietnam years, I know that I served alongside many who were either draftees or who joined to avoid the draft, whose lives were vastly improved by their military service. One way or another, they answered the call to duty. They learned discipline, teamwork, and the importance of character over wealth, privilege, education, or ethnicity. They came from all walks of life, but they were shaped into one, at least for a while. They wore the same clothes, called uniforms, which is more significant than it sounds. The very word uniform conveys the fact that their personal tastes and habits were disregarded in favor of uniformity. While uniformity in dress may be a relatively trivial concept to the average non-military person, to those who wear the uniform it is much more than merely a symbol. It is an acknowledgement that the wearer has sublimated his or her personal preferences to a greater cause, service to their nation, and it requires cohesion. There's some societal cost to having only 7% of adults with that experience. When it was higher, it may have made societal unity somewhat easier. Our society is certainly more fractious now than it was then. The qualities of courage, pride, determination, selflessness, dedication to duty, and personal integrity that were drilled into them prepared them to serve a cause larger than themselves. As with trends in the U.S. population overall, the veteran population will become more racially and ethnically diverse. Between 2021 and 2046, the share of veterans who are non-Hispanic white is expected to drop from 74% to 62%. The share of veterans who are Hispanic is expected to double from 8% to 16%, while the share who are black is expected to increase slightly from 13% to 15%. Fewer members of Congress have prior military experience than in the past. As the share of Americans who are veterans has declined, so has the share of legislators who have previously served in the military. In the current Congress, 17% of lawmakers in both houses had prior military service, down drastically from just a few decades ago. The share of senators who are veterans reached a post-Korean War peak of 81% in 1975, while the share among House members peaked in 1967 at 75%. However, in recent elections, both Democrats and Republicans have made special efforts to recruit veterans for congressional contests, and the newly elected freshman class includes 15 such lawmakers. Would our dysfunctional Congress function more smoothly if 80% or so of its members had been required to work together closely, cohesively, in the military? Veterans Day, originally called Armistice Day, was designated as a day to celebrate the end of World War I. The First World War ended on November 11th in 1918, and legislation that created Veterans Day was, and I quote, "dedicated to the cause of world peace and to hereafter be celebrated and known as Armistice Day." As time went on and we engaged in further conflicts during World War II in Korea, veterans groups lobbied for change. Rather than honoring the armistice and only those who served in World War I, the holiday would now honor all veterans from every war and conflict the United States has encountered. We've honored our troops and their service and sacrifice ever since. This week, people throughout the country gathered together to remember, to honor, and to pay gratitude to those who served our country. They came together as a way to say, "We remember." From the soldiers who shivered and starved through the winter of Valley Forge, to the doughboys crouched in the muddy trenches of France, to the platoon who patrolled the hazy jungles of Vietnam, to the young man or woman patrolling the mountains of Afghanistan, and to those who never saw combat but were prepared for it if needed, we remember and honor them all. That's why Veterans Day is such a meaningful American holiday. Veterans are the backbone of American society, and as we remember them, we might also think about how to appreciate them and put them in positions of leadership. Our nation needs them now as it did then. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WMRV AM and FM in Fayetteville, North Carolina, along with WMIR AM in Myrtle Beach, North Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.